Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the podcast that follows the ever-dwindling money behind our beautiful game. You'll be glad to know that my birthday hangover has gone, and the man you're about to hear, of course, has never had a hangover. Mind you, I've never had special cuddles from a girl in Moscow wearing a Barcelona shirt, so, you know, swings and roundabouts, isn't it, Kieran? So this is, of course, Kieran Maguire, Professor of Football Finance at Liverpool University, fresh from Norwegian television.
That's right. That was a strange one. My Norwegian hasn't improved as a result of the interview, but I nodded convincingly when they were talking in the local language.
Yes, I once filmed with some Liverpool fans from Oslo. We flew from Oslo to Liverpool. I've never seen men more drunk in my life. They were astonishing. And we arranged to meet them before the game the next day at this particular pub. And I went there and the bouncer went, "If you're looking for the Norwegians, they're bad." I said, "Mate, they only got here at midnight last night." He said, "They did enough damage in 2 hours." And after the game, this is still my favourite thing, they were lovely. And after the game, I met up with one of them. And I said, "Where's the other one?" He said, "Oh, he gets so drunk that the only way he can remember the game is by buying a shirt afterwards. And he has the result and the name of the scorers printed on the shirt." And I was really, so I said, "Yeah, so like they'd beaten Fulham." So he was in there for ages while he had 4-0, all the scorers burned. And I said, "What does his wife think of this?" He went, "He's not married."
Very wise.
It's Thursday, Kieran, so it's Stories Day today. Rather, interesting that we're getting so many questions that what's traditionally meant to be our shorter pod on the Mondays getting longer and longer, which is great. But we do have plenty of stories for you today. And some big names in the game have been voicing opinions about how long this can go on for. We start with Rick Parry, Chief Executive of the EFL, of course. He said, now this is interesting because I would have thought July the 31st would be a deadline for starting it. He said this season needs to be concluded by July the 31st. That seems to be quite a short deadline, but why that specific date?
Well, it's very much driven by contracts. All footballers' contracts, when you sign a 1 or a 2 year, whatever it's going to be, they have a traditional finish date of the 30th of June. But it's also there's a commitment by clubs is that they will pay you effectively an extra month's wages to allow you to find another club. So I think what the EFL have done here, and this does make some form of sense, is they say, well, therefore, given that the player is being paid by the club up to the 31st of July, it makes sense to enable us to play matches in that additional period of time. It is very much going to go to the wire. There's a hell of a lot of matches to play, and there doesn't appear to be a consensus within the EFL owners themselves, especially when we look at Leagues 1 and 2, because the owners have said, and we've had this discussion, I'm getting no money coming in from hosting matches. I've had to take the players out of furlough, so I've got not just the wage costs, but I've got all the other admin costs to go along with it. I can't do it.
Well, that's a discussion that's being had lower down the pyramid as well, as we'll find out later on when we talk about Dulwich Hamlet. But Rick Parry talked about the EFL being in a £2 million hole by September if this continues. Now, given what you've said to us about the finances of the EFL in previous pods, that doesn't seem too high a figure. I mean, it seems that the EFL was in a financial hole anyway. So £200 million, when I first saw that, I thought, oh, God, that seems manageable, but clearly not.
Well, it's 200 million more, I suspect, is what he's meaning.
Okay.
If you take a look at the Championship's got a gross monthly wage bill of 68 million. Now, even if we take advantage of the government's pay delay scheme, you know, I think that you're probably looking at a net 40 to 45 million pounds is going out of that division. You get to the end of September. So, yeah, we're talking, you know, we're at £200 million. And that's being, I think that's actually being quite generous because we've got clubs that have got commitments to pay transfer fee installments. And yeah, they've got to pay the rent. They've got to pay the other costs. So £200 million is, on the basis, I suspect, that they're going to have something to sell to the broadcasters. And actually, they've got some form of money coming in. but it's a huge amount of money. We've seen various schemes put forward by people in the game. I think Darren McAntony, the Peterborough chairman, has effectively said, let's try and get an advance on the next 5 years of TV money. But that again is sort of, to a certain extent, kicking things down the road. Eventually, if you borrow money or if you take advances, you can't carry on doing that, as many people have found with credit cards.
Well, and funny enough, a lot of people in my industry, the entertainment industry, who have been hit hard are being offered loans left, right, and centre. But again, in the short term, it seems like a good idea, but we'll still be paying those loans off in 5 years' time, and we're all freelance, so you never know. I'm glad you mentioned broadcasters there, Kieran, because several people have asked me for clarification on the broadcasting thing. Now, clubs will have been paid this season's broadcasting rights at the start of the season, but what they're missing out on in terms of broadcasting is the extra game bonus, I presume. And could you just clarify what the situation is for broadcasting companies at the moment and what clubs are missing out and by how much?
Right. I mean, the way that it works is that Sky and BT put down a huge deposit before the start of the season. So effectively, sort of, you know, in early June, they write a very large cheque to the Premier League.
And that's, and the reason, sorry to interrupt, that's to finance the transfer window, is that right?
That's to finance the transfer window. And that's good, because you've got these clubs that have just been promoted from the Championship. They want to be able to recruit decent players. And so that's in the Premier League's interest. It's also in the broadcasters' interest, because it gives them something to fill the airwaves with. You know, if you give the clubs money, they go out and spend it. We've got a story. So everybody wins from that. And then over the course of the season, they sort of make two or three top-up payments. And the Premier League gives a lot of money out in June, and then again it's sort of two or three payments during the year, with a big final payment which is based on your league position, the number of matches you played, and so on. So it looks as if the Premier League is advancing money to the Football League, to the EFL, from the money it's received from the broadcasters, and is also advancing money to the clubs themselves. And that's fine as BT Sport and Sky Sports are concerned, but the Premier League is a fantastic export for this country. And as we know, lots of broadcasters around the rest of the world have been keen to snap up the rights, but they're more keen to pay on a monthly basis. Uh-huh. So they've not received matches in March, so they haven't paid the March instalments, right, the April instalments, and they ain't going to pay the May instalments either until they have something to show to their subscribers. So that's where the problem lies. So I don't think the Premier League will have to hand money back to the overseas broadcasters simply because they're not being paid in the first place. Right. There is conceptually a potential to repay BT Sport and Sky if the Premier League doesn't finish, and that principle will also apply to the EFL with its deal with Sky. Now, it's not in Sky's interest to demand the money back because clubs will go out of business. So I think Sky are trying to do the right thing here for both the football clubs, the football authorities, and themselves. So again, you know, it's a win-win, but that can't continue indefinitely.
Well, sticking with the EFL, because we haven't finished with Rick Perry yet, which I don't know why, it seems to me a sentence has probably been used before. I don't know why. It strikes me that people have said that about Rick Parry before. He said, now I'm interested in this, I'd like you to elaborate, if you could, what he means by this. And I'm quoting here. He said the EFL will need a post-COVID reset when all this is over. What exactly does he mean by that, do you think?
Well, I think, you know, over the course of the show, we have suggested that the present rules are not fit for purpose in terms of wage control, in terms of financial fair play, which is now called profitability and sustainability, which is crazy because it doesn't encourage profitability and it doesn't encourage sustainability, because it allows clubs to, in fact, effectively encourages clubs to sell their stadiums to try to go and, you know, as we always say, twist on 19, sell your stadium, get a load of money and try to get promotion on the back of that. So if this means that the club owners are going to take their responsibilities seriously in the post-COVID environment, I very much welcome it. I think Rick will be in a stronger position to persuade more people, because so many clubs will have come so close to going under that they might listen to common sense. In the past, I think his predecessors have been casual in their response in their responsibilities towards the long term interests of the game. They've let individual owners effectively walk through the rules, and the rules were so weak anyway. So there is an opportunity. He also described the parachute payments, and you know, we've had this discussion on many occasions, as an evil that needs to be eradicated, which is the type of thing you'd expect in a Doctor Who episode. So, you know, my view of parachute payments is they're good for the Premier League. They're not good for clubs in the Championship. So the problem we've got here is, how does the EFL persuade the Premier League clubs to get rid of parachute payments? Because let's take your position. Let's say that Palace went down. Clearly, they're not going to do so. But if Palace went down, you've got Wilfried Zaha, probably the best player outside of the top six in the Premier League. You know, and that's coming from a Brighton fan, so I'm saying it. You know,
big of you.
I'm saying it objectively. Yeah. But he's paid the same salary as a Premier League player. So he's probably on, you know, £6 to £7 million a year. You can't expect him to accept the £6,000 a week, you know, effectively to go from £6 million a year to £350,000 a year if Palace dropped into the Championship. That's the purpose of parachute payments. Now, if you say, well, hold on, he'd go to a Premier League club, Steve Parish wouldn't be very happy about that, because immediately Palace are relegated. The Premier League clubs are going to say, well, we know he's going to be really unhappy. We're going to start putting in derisory offers. So it's not in the interests of the Premier League to get rid of parachute payments, unless you are Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea and those clubs which are never going to get relegated.
Well, first of all, as a Brighton fan, I don't care whether you think Wilfried Zaha's good or not, basically. So of no interest to me. All you need to know is that he's just too good for you, essentially. The parachute payment thing, though, that confuses me as an evil. And I also like the fact that you say you've suggested that the EFL rules are not fit for purpose. You've 100% proved that the EFL rules are not fit for purpose. You went way beyond suggestion, my friend. The parachute payment thing, I don't understand why that's so bad, because in terms of competition, history has shown us that it's very, very difficult for relegated clubs to bounce straight back. So it's not, it doesn't seem to me that it is giving relegated clubs an edge, an unfair advantage. It just seems to me it's helping them not go out of business. I don't quite see why Rick Parry thinks they're so evil.
Well, if you take a look at the positions of the clubs that have been relegated, think about clubs that have gone down in the past few years. Middlesbrough, Sunderland, who are now in League One, have been there for 2 years, and they're still receiving parachute payments, by the way.
So
if they can't get out of League One with parachute payments from the Premier League, it does appear to indicate that they're not perfect, but Hull City, Swansea, Stoke, all clubs who have received large parachute payments. The argument against parachute payments, and this certainly does have some validity, is that if you are Leeds, Forest, Derby, clubs of that stature, and you want to have a punt for promotion, you're going to have to go and increase your wages to make sure that they're not too far behind those of the clubs that are coming down. So that's the problem. Working out a solution for it is going to take... It's not going to be a quick and easy fix, because we've had this discussion before. You've got a previous history of working in HR. You can't rewrite contracts unilaterally.
Yeah, let's not go too deeply into my previous history in HR, because we've got an accountant. This pod's dull enough already with an accountant and a comedian. If we're talking about an accountant and a human resources person, it was a long time ago, people. It was so long ago, it was still personnel when I was doing it. It wasn't even human resources. I still don't know how many N's and how many L's are involved. One more thing from Rick Parry. I don't know whether this is advice or a threat or a warning, but basically we know that clubs like West Ham, for example, are very keen for the season either to stop now or to continue without relegation. And as we've discussed, I wonder why that would be. But Rick Parry has said, and I'm quoting, it will be very messy legally if there is no relegation from the Premier League.
Yeah, and I've been sort of following this over the course of the weekend. I think there's only one or two clubs that were pushing for the no relegation. There's no desire, I think, to have the season ended with the possible exception of West Ham, because of the fear of having to pay money back to overseas broadcasters at least. If there's no relegation, there's no interest for broadcasters themselves. There's nothing really to show because Liverpool have already won the Premier League. I think the fear of that there's no relegation, does that also mean no promotion? And that's when things would get messy. Mm. At present, there is a legal document between the Premier League and the EFL, which says that at the end of each season, three clubs will be relegated and three clubs will be promoted. So therefore, if the Premier League tries to get out of that, they're effectively in breach of contract. And also, if you think about it from the EFL's point of view, potentially having Villa and Norwich and Bournemouth or West Ham or Brighton or whoever it's going to be in the Championship increases the quality of the game that they have to offer. So you can see it from their point of view. Is it going to get messy? Yeah. Are our silver-tongued friends going to be once again, and let's face it, the UK car industry is in a bit of a tickle. This could be a boost for Range Rover sales.
I think, to be fair to the accountants and the lawyers and the agents that you refer to as our silver tongued friends, I think they say the same thing about you, Kieran, as well, to be perfectly honest. Our silver tongued Rain Man. Now, still in the Championship, you've talked long and hard on this pod about the overspend in the Championship, about how the finances just don't add up in the Championship. And there's been a report this weekend which would indicate perhaps why. Now, I looked at some of these figures, and I'm so used to seeing loads of noughts after Premier League season, you kind of don't know whether these are good or not. But with reports that there are physios on £190,000 plus, kit men on 50,000. Now, I don't know what a kit man gets in the Premier League, for example, so I don't know what these figures are. But it would seem to me that if there are physios and kit men on that sort of money, then it's no surprise that the Championship is in a bit of a quandary financially.
Yes, and again, this has been leaked document, and I think the EFL will be highly hacked off at the leak. But yeah, that's the nature of the world we're in.
Did you hang on before we carry on? Let's just make this clear. As I'm worried now, you didn't leak it, did you?
Not me, no. I'm a fine, upstanding citizen, as we all know, in this country.
Yeah, the people who only listen to the broadcast bits of the pod know that. Yeah, those of us who know some of the... Yeah, and I'm... Yes. Yeah, carry on.
So the EFL sent round a questionnaire, by all accounts, to the clubs, where they said, can you put down details of your highest paid player, the manager, and various other, just to get a benchmark for what individual positions are earning. Now, this report was then published, or extracts of it were published in the Mail. And it appeared to indicate, as you said, there's a physio on 190 grand, there's a kit man on 50 grand. And again, I'm not saying that's wrong, but if you are having this level of expenditure, it's no surprise that overall the Championship is spending £107 on wages for £100 that comes in. That there's a manager on, I think it was around about 3.3 million. My suspicion that would be Bielsa at Leeds, because he is an amazing manager, a very intense guy, and Leeds fans will say he's worth every penny. The top paid player, 68k a week, that's Mitrovic in Fulham, would be an inspired guess, shall I say?
Well, no, I can say, I mean, it's not our position to judge who should be paid what, to be perfectly honest. Yeah. As you've made plain when our obsession with Premier League wages, for example. But a physio is doing a very important job at a football club. A physio is helping manage, in a cynical way, is helping to manage the assets and make them better. I know for a fact that, I don't know how much Danny the Kitman at Palace earns, but I know for a fact that he's a vital part of the well-being of the players all love him. He's a fantastic contact between the foundation and the club. So I wouldn't resent any money that he gets. So I think maybe players and people in football wouldn't be surprised at these wages. It's more people outside the game that would be raising eyebrows at these numbers.
Yes, and I think it all comes back to this constant narrative that people in football don't deserve to be paid what they're paid. I've known the world of finance for a few years. Seeing some of the bonuses paid to bankers and hedge fund managers and so on. footballers entertain people. Remember who it was that caused the global economic crash in 2007. It wasn't footballers. It was, you know, this rather unholy alliance between ratings agencies, banks lending money to people that couldn't repay, and so on. And nobody suffered as a result of that long term, because the bankers are back on the big bonuses and so on.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Now, still in the Premier League, Steve Parish, who is chairman of the oldest club in the Football League, Crystal Palace, he's had some criticism this week, unfairly, I think, and I would say that, because he wrote in his column in the Sunday Times that he predicted similar problems for Premier League football clubs and the rest of football to airlines if we don't start playing by August. And I think this deserves a little bit of context. Steve deserves a little bit of context. He's not, as he's been accused of, one of these old-fashioned, greedy, 70s-style club owners who just wants to ride roughshod over the safety of his players to make profit. You know, the day after lockdown was announced, Steve Parish identified every single season ticket holder over the age of 70 on the Palace database, contacted them to see if they needed financial help, if they needed counselling, did they have neighbours, etc. The catering staff at Palace are turning out hundreds of meals a day, which are being delivered to homeless people, local charities, etc. So this is a man who's aware of his commitment to the community, but he's also a businessman, and he's also very keen to see the club through this crisis so that there is a club left after it. And I think it reflects the fact that what he's saying is, you know, we saw Richard Branson within days laying staff off without pay. He's put it's like a James Bond plot. He's put his island up for security for a possible loan. So I don't think Steve was saying anything that we don't. And also, what all Steve's doing is elaborating what you've been saying, is that apart from maybe the top six or seven in the Premier League, every club outside that is in, for every day that this carries on, is in trouble.
Yep, and also, if you take a look at is it Phil Garlick, the guy in charge of Burnley, he said similar. Yeah, we look at you're effectively got 20 sand timers in the Premier League, and you've got the money going out on a monthly basis. Palace's wage bill is around about £10 million a month. Now, how can anybody? Yeah, that would be about £10 million a month gross.
Wow, I'm quite pleased about that. We're a big club.
And that's fine if you've got £10 million a month coming in.
Of course.
And this applies to, as you say, all the clubs outside the Big Six, and even the Big Six aren't immune. And as a result of that, all that Steve's done, and as have other chief executives of clubs, have said, this cannot continue indefinitely. We've got some money. Yeah, we've got squirrels aside, which to allow us to survive. We can't rely on the transfer market this summer because prices are going to collapse. And those clubs whose models that are based on selling players, and we were discussing Brentford last week, they're going to take a real hit because of the collapse of the transfer market. So what he simply said is just put it out there. If you've not got money in and you've got large commitments going out, which you cannot reverse your way out of, if you write off the contract, the player walks away for nothing.
And club doctors have made a statement saying this will be difficult to guarantee players' safety and health. But Steve Parish, along with everybody else in football, will put the players' health and safety first and foremost. If it can't be done safely, it won't be done. But yeah, he's right. We want, and I think Steve's comments about football being magnificently meaningless and having even a tiny, tiny effect on the mental well-being of all of us if we've got something trivial to talk about. I think that's an important point as well. But I don't think anybody's suggesting that the players' health and safety will be rode roughshod, or indeed, everybody else who works for the game. So I was a little disappointed with some of the criticism he got, because I would say that anyway, but somebody I think who possibly, I don't know where I stand legally here, if I say probably or possibly, deserves a bit of criticism. I think I'm legally all right for saying probably somebody deserves a bit of criticism. Occasionally, probably I deserve a bit of criticism. I don't know. I'm very good looking, very funny. But Gordon Taylor, the PFA chief executive, and friend to this show, in that we get quite a few minutes out of him on most pods. One of his suggestions is that the season continue, but by playing shorter games. But he might be saying that to distract us from the fact that the PFA charity has failed to file annual accounts. Is that significant?
Well, yeah, I don't think it reflects particularly well on the PFA charity. Historically, it's got a year end of the, I think, the 30th of June, and it normally sends its in accounts around about November. Now, the deadline is the 31st of March, and as we've mentioned this on one or two occasions before, the Chancellor said that I'm going to give you an extra 3 months. Now, some clubs have taken advantage of that. Most clubs have said, no, we'll send them out. Yeah, we've got nothing to hide. The issues in respect of Gordon Taylor is that if you take a look at the Scottish PFA, their chief executive last year earned £83,459. If you then go to the PFA, Gordon Taylor, £2,292,904.
Wow.
So his pay is 2,647%. As you can imagine, I had calculator envy here when I was crunching these out. And even I couldn't do these ones in my head. So yeah, they're big numbers, big sums here. So he has come in for criticism for his salary before. Again, we're not going to say whether that's right or wrong.
I'm going wrong this time.
Right. How does that reflect? Well, but by not showing the accounts, it means that we can't see Gordon Taylor's, how much did he earn in 2018-19? We've had Dave Kitson effectively throwing his hat into the ring to be an alternative. And Dave's an articulate bloke. He's come in for criticism himself on one or two issues, but you know, he's certainly, when I've seen him talking on the television, he has put forward a form of manifesto. And the other issue is that we won't find out how much the PFA has got in its bank account and how much has it got as investments. Mark Palios, the Tranmere owner, he was writing in The Guardian yesterday, and he was saying the PFA needs to step up. They need to help clubs in terms of dealing with wages. You know, how much has the PFA itself got to do to contribute towards this ongoing crisis? Now, in the most recent accounts, which was the 2018, I think the PFA had around about, you know, £40 to £45 million worth of investments. So, you know, these would be, you know, shares and paintings of Lowry and, you know, bonds and things of that nature. So could they make a contribution towards helping clubs in the short term? So that's the argument that's put forward. By not publishing the accounts, there could be a perfectly legitimate reason for it. It could be that the auditors have been unable to do the work. But that's inconsistent with historically publishing the results in November. So, you know, he's going to take criticism for this because he's a man in the spotlight, Gordon Taylor. And by taking this action, I don't think he's necessarily helped himself.
Now, can you just clarify this for me, because I had to do it, because when I read the words the PFA charity has failed, my initial thought was this is a charity run by the PFA, but the PFA charity is the PFA, isn't it, essentially?
In effect, is a charitable... yes, that's correct.
Right, okay, so we are talking about the PFA here, so perhaps me saying PFA charity might have thrown some people off the scent, but they're back on the scent now. Further down the pyramid, you've been looking at a couple of clubs, one a long, long way from here and one not too far. Hartlepool, most of us follow Hartlepool by default because Jeff Stelling is such a big, passionate Hartlepool fan. I still yet to get over his rant about the sack getting Dave Jones sacked. And what's strange about Jeff is when you see him in private, he's quite a small man.
Really?
You know, yeah, pugnacious. But I mean, lovely, charming. But, you know, I wouldn't... I wouldn't beat him at pool in a pub. That'd be my advice. If you walked into Jeff's pub in Hartlepool, I'd let him win. Let's put it that way. But Hartlepool, you've been looking at their situation. They're in a bit of trouble, aren't they? I mean, every club in their situation is, but Hartlepool are.
Yeah, I mean, I've got an affection for Hartlepool for a variety of reasons, not least the first date I ever went on with the Baroness was, I said to her, do you like football? She said yes. I said, oh, well, we're playing on Saturday. I took her to Hartlepool. What I didn't realise was that her ex-husband was quite senior at Manchester United, and she'd previously been to Champions League finals in the players' lounge, so she was used to that type of environment. And I took her to Hartlepool. We lost 2-1, so therefore I didn't speak on the whole journey back. You know what it's like when you've lost. We managed the second date. So
do you know what, Kieran? I wish, just as a competition, I'd put out there, which town do you think that Kieran Maguire, he of Thailand fame, he of Moscow fame, he of Trinidad fame, which town do you think he took his wife too on their first? I'm guessing many people wouldn't have gone for Hartlepool, frankly.
I think you'd have probably kept your winnings on that one.
I think I've only really known you since October, but I've got to know you well enough, and of course I to like you well enough, to know that it wouldn't have occurred to you to think it was an odd place to take the Baroness. You say, this will cheer us, hilarious. Oh dear, that's very good. My soft spot for Hartlepool, of course, is that they were Brian Clough's first club, and I love the fact that they were used to really tickle me as a kid, which is a bit, you know, I was a strange child. I used to love the fact they were Hartlepool's United, because it was two Hartlepool teams who joined together, and they were very proud of the S. So I was quite sad when they dropped the Hartlepool's United to just become Hartlepool. But anyway, this is all by way of a light-hearted meander into a serious subject. Sorry about that, Hartlepool.
Well, Hartlepool, they nearly went under, as you're probably aware, in recent years. So you would have thought that they'd be trying to run a fairly tight ship. But I think these results, their losses have halved, but they still lost $860,000 in 2019 in the National League. And I think it goes to show that just because you're out of the hurly-burly of the EFL, it's still really tough running a football club, regardless of the level. I was on another show this morning with the owner of Kings Lynn.
You on another show with the owner of Kings Lynn, you say?
Yeah. We
just days after talking to the Shadow Cabinet. Oh my goodness! Right, okay.
Hartlepool, yeah. so Hartlepool lost £860,000. Now, you cannot carry on doing that unless you've got an owner who can constantly bail you out. And this is the real risk that we're in football. So many clubs are losing money, as we saw what's happened with the likes of Bury and Bolton and Macclesfield now and Oldham. If the owners decide to turn the taps off for whatever reason, either won't pay or can't pay, the club simply can't carry on by themselves. And until this issue is addressed, and I don't know, I don't think there's an easy solution for it, the risks attached to football are going to continue.
I'm willing to bet that can't pay, won't pay is probably your favourite Dario Fo play, isn't it?
Yes.
I would guess. I imagine you're a big fan of the Italian anarchist theatre genre. What did the owner of King... I interrupted you before we found out what the owner of King's Lynn had to say on your latest television escapade.
Oh, no, this was his own podcast. He set up a podcast.
What?
A podcast called I Bought a Football Club.
Oh, okay.
So fair play to him. He's saying he's finding it a lot tougher than he initially envisaged. He's managed to triple gates, but you know, if you triple gates and get promoted, you've got higher costs of players. Yeah. You know, it's whatever level of football, it's a labour of love, and just empty your pockets if you're an owner.
Do you know what? I don't mind you doing TV and radio stuff, but I'm strangely disappointed that you've done another pod. I don't know why. I just feel a bit. I don't know what to think about that, Chris. But a club at a slightly lower level. Every person listening to this, wherever they are in England or across the world, I know we have people listening to us all over the place, in Scotland, Northern Ireland, wherever you are, there will be a little group of non-league clubs that you grew up quite liking and occasionally going to when your club was away. So we're around here, Palace fans, Sutton United, Carshalton, Tooting and Mitcham, Corinthian Casuals, and one of those was Dulwich Hamlet, which is 20 minutes from where I live by car, but towards the east, so I don't particularly like to go in that direction. Big SW postcode person. But Dulwich Hamlet, who have recently marketed themselves as a kind of trendy posers club, essentially. They're sort of going down the Forest Green route, if you like, and ethical, sustainable. You get a lot of fans there with beards. You know, it's very much cocktails out of a jam jar sort of club. And because of that, I think I probably thought that their fan base and the club was probably had a bit of money in their pocket. But they very nearly went out of business last week. But there's a very specific reason why they didn't go out of business, isn't there, that their chairman has been talking about.
That's right. I mean, I read this in the Southwark Gazette because, I mean, I am an Elephant and Castle guy. Yeah, that's where I was born. So this was, again, a club close to where I grew up as a kid. They said the only reason why they are presently in existence is the fact that football was closed down in the non-league pyramid. And I think it, you know, there has been some debate, and clearly there have been clubs that have lost out as a result of not being promoted and things of this nature. But it does bring into context the broader issue of self-interest versus existence.
Yeah, before we go on to that, because you had some very strong things to say about those things, could you explain maybe for some of our newer listeners, and let's face it, for me, as I don't always pay attention, why has ending the season saved their life?
Well, if the matches had to be played for the remainder of the season, then players would have to be paid. They couldn't be in furlough. You would have ground maintenance costs. You would have the costs of running the office, of preparing for matches, and you'd have no revenue.
Right.
So you've got money going out, and you've got nothing coming in.
Right.
And he said they went from hoping to be £100,000 in the black to £200,000 in the red if they'd had to fulfil the fixtures. And he said, I can't physically do it. Yeah. I'm not rich enough, man, to subsidise the club to that extent. You know, I think it does bring into focus that what we will probably see moving up the leagues, we've seen it in the national leagues and below, that leagues one and two could easily go down this route as well because the costs of running the matches for those local owners. And this is the bun fight that's presently taking place between those clubs which have got a chance of promotion and those clubs which don't.
I'm guessing then that for a club there in National League South, £100,000 in the black would be healthy, would it, for a club that size?
Oh, yeah, that would be a superb achievement. No doubt about it.
Good. Well, again, it's... I'm interested in his words because they were strong words because, again, the clubs voted on this. His name's Ben Clasper, which is a great name, I think, for somebody who runs a football club. He talked about the one or two clubs, as you say, who are very angry about missing out on promotion. But he said there were frank words were exchanged between some club owners because he said some club owners, their idea of helping the National League is by escaping to the Football League, basically. So he said they had no interest at all in any kind of unity in that level of football. And also said, and I thought this was a really interesting quote, is he said, the first thing you've got to do, this is all in quotes, first you've got to save the club, then you can argue for as long as you like about who goes up and who goes down. So essentially this step has saved not just Dulwich Hamlet then, a lot of clubs will have been saved by this step. And then, as you say, we can then argue about what should have happened or what might happen.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, let's do that at another point. Yeah, 30,000 people have died.
Yeah,
you know, and that's important. Yeah. Getting promoted or not getting promoted, it's absolutely nothing. It's a completely meaningless issue in the wider context of your life.
Yeah, I suppose you know, a club like Dulwich Hamlet will probably never be in the league. I mean, if you look where their ground is, it's surrounded by housing estates, whatever, despite no matter how trendy it is. But it's not important. We know that. But for the 2,000 people who go to Dulwich Hamlet regularly, losing it would be a loss. And of course, we put it into the context of actual lives lost. But it is important to save football clubs. What league they play in is what's not important, essentially. I think we both agree on that. And I think most people listening to this pod would think the same way. None of us think that football should get extra help when other businesses are going out. But I think saving football clubs in a wider social context is very important. And then, as Ben says, you can then argue about, yeah, you can get promoted next year, you can get promoted the year after that. but you can't if there's no football club in existence, essentially. And also, his point is as well that you know getting relegated, getting promoted to the National League or to League Two isn't necessarily going to help you at this current stage of events anyway. So that's, I think, his disappointment at the lack of unity was clear, although for the most part, the vote was fairly unanimous, wasn't it, that they should stop football?
That's right. There was over 90% in favour. Those clubs that have missed out, yes, so what? I mean, there is a case for saying that Barrow ought to be brought into the Interleague 2 next season, simply because it will bring it up to 92 clubs.
Yeah, that's interesting. Do you think that will happen?
I think there's a logic in it. It would save some legal costs. You know, going back to what Rick Parry was saying, that things could get very messy legally. Well, I think this is one way of reducing one further piece of litigation.
Do you know what I'd like to see? I'd like to see Barrow back in the league. I'd like to see Workington back in the league, and Southport. Because as a kid, my knowledge of English geography was based entirely on my shoot league tables. Right? If there wasn't a little cardboard slip that I could put in my shoot, I wouldn't have heard of Barrow. I wouldn't have known where Workington was, but instead you become fascinated by these far off places. So there's a lot of names out there that you'd like to see back in the league, and because you know clubs like Barrow are clubs that nearly went out of existence, have been eking out for years. So it would be the romantic in me, and let's face it, this pod is about romance at heart. The romantic in me would like to see Barrow back in the league, actually.
Yes, and by all accounts, that yeah, they've been a very good team in the National League this season. So I can't see who would object to it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I'll tell you, the even more romantic part, we would like to see Bury back in the league, let's put it that way. But if that can't happen, then Barrow, this same number of syllables, it's vaguely, it's a lot further north, isn't it? But no, that would be nice to see. And I think that's quite a nice positive note to end this pod on. The Price of Football, that's us. I was reaching for the name now. I actually had to look down to see what this pod was called. See, you've got an excuse because you're selling yourself to any pod, the highest bidder, essentially. I'm doing a Palace pod later, but that doesn't. The Price of Football is a Dap Dip production. Next week, we'll be back on Monday with our questions pod, which is proving a very interesting pod at the moment, the questions pod. So if you do have questions for us, and I know you do because we've got a backlog, that's questions@priceoffootball.com. In the meantime, we hope you have a lovely weekend. And I hope, Kieran, you and the Baroness can reminisce about the Heady Hartlepool days.
Thank you very much. Stay safe, boys and girls.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.